This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll talk with LSU Mass Communications Professor Judith Sylvester. Dr. Sylvester is attempting with others to make LSU a tobacco and smoke-free campus. Current policy requires people to smoke 25 feet away from the entrance to any building. We will talk with Dr. Sylvester about this effort. Also on the show today, we are scheduled to have a visit, if everything goes according to plan, with the last man to win 30 games in a major league season, Dennis Dale McLean. Denny McLean, he did it in 1968 at the age of 24 with the Detroit Tigers. He's the only pitcher since 1934 to accomplish this. And this is, of course, a big time for Major League Baseball. We'll talk, if things go according to plan, with Denny McLean. But first, the news. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Kevin Gallagher producing. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. The email address, inkstershow@wrkf.org. We will have Dr. Judith Sylvester in studio in just a moment, professor of mass communications at LSU, and she has some provocative words about smoking, as in not smoking, on the campus of the old war school. First, Congressman Bill Cassidy has freed up his schedule and says he will appear at today's debate of the 6th District congressional candidates at the Press Club, 320 3rd Street, De La Ron Hall, high noon. Congressman Cassidy says he will be there, and hats off to the congressman, who, of course, is debating two lesser-known challengers. And for those who don't think debates can have an effect on a race, three national polls have been released this morning. And Politico has President Obama 49%, Governor Romney 48%. Gallup has it 47-47, and Rasmussen has it 48-48. So, folks, this is a tight race with 29 days to go. And at times through the years, there has been hyperbole. For example, there were people who were saying 4 years ago that Obama and McCain would have a tight race, and anybody who was looking at polls knew that that was not likely to be the case. In this case, it is true, and it should be a fascinating ride to November 6th, and we will follow it every step of the way right here on this program and through the national shows you hear on WRKF. 297-5633 is your number. Good morning to you, Dr. Sylvester.
Good morning.
And you have been at LSU for 17 years. Dr. Sylvester is a graduate of one of the great journalism schools in North America or anywhere else, the University of Missouri. And she is at the forefront of an effort by some folks on campus to follow the lead of Southern University and Nicholls State University and many others around the country, making LSU a tobacco and smoke-free campus. What do you think? Why so? Why do you want to do it?
Well, we have to look at this from a pretty broad perspective and understand that it's not just an LSU problem, that it's also a state problem. It's also a national problem. So what we're trying to do at this juncture is to bring LSU to the status that a lot of other campuses, including some SEC schools such as Kentucky, University of Missouri, University of Arkansas, Auburn, that have already taken steps in this direction. And I want to make it clear that we're really talking tobacco-free. There's a distinction, because if you talk just smoke-free, then you're only talking about cigarettes, cigars, pipes, that sort of thing. But when we get into tobacco, then we can also include some of the new products that are coming out from tobacco companies that are being aimed directly at college-age students, like e-cigarettes and dissolvables and some of these other products. So we want it to be tobacco-free.
Chewing tobacco, that would be a no-no too?
Yes, because you've got to put this in perspective too. What's happening in National League Baseball? That's been the bastion of tobacco use for a long time. And there's all sorts of efforts now in Little League and in Major League Baseball to get it out of the stadiums and out of their players. And we definitely would want to include our baseball team in that movement as well.
877-217-5757. Should LSU be a smoke-free campus? I recall years ago when smoking was allowed at Tiger Stadium, there were many who thought that they would never ban smoking in an outdoor arena, but they did. Mm-hmm. Smoking was once allowed in the Louisiana Superdome in an indoor arena. You'd have to go through the haze to see, or look through the haze to see field goals by games in, because there was a big smog collecting over the field. But LSU, for the most part, I don't see many people smoking on campus, and I'm there quite often, but you say otherwise. You're
I
there
say
more
otherwise.
Than I. Well, what kind of situation do we have?
Well, let's. You like statistics, so I'm going to give you some statistics
here.
We know from survey research that I've done, and I've been tracking this for 12 years, that the rates among our undergraduates are the highest they've ever been, and it's getting really close to 30%. Now, that's the social smokers as well as the regular smokers. But at least a third of those tell us that they smoke on campus daily. And if we expand that to look at our whole campus community, which is about 34,000 now, we're not quite there, but pretty close, and that would include faculty, staff, everything, we know that the overall smoking rate is about 19%. Which is pretty close to the national average. But as a state, we're ahead in all categories. We have more smokers. We have more high school students beginning to smoke and all of these sorts of things. So we have a real litter problem on campus, aside from the health issues. So we have 34,000 people, about 19% smoke. I'll give them an average of 2 cigarettes a day, 5 days a week. I'm not even counting Saturdays here. That's about 64,600 cigarettes that are smoked on our campus every week. And most of those butts end up on the grounds of our campus.
Well, one time I do see a lot of cigarette butts on campus is after an LSU football game. Mm-hmm. And, excuse me, and people do this outside the arena, and they leave their refuse for the rest of the people to observe, and it makes a pristine campus look less than that. Come Saturday night, Sunday morning, and then the prisoners come out and clean it up magically early in the morning, and the campus is restored to its splendor. But this ban you're talking about would include LSU football games, would it not?
Eventually, that would be the goal. And like I said, there are other campuses like the University of Kentucky, University of Missouri. It's a total thing. And that's the goal. But are we going to do that tomorrow? No. Do we expect 100% compliance? No. But nevertheless, the whole goal is to change the campus culture. So it's simply not acceptable for people to smoke on our campus and, in particular, leave those butts behind. And I also want to point out that 70% of us on campus do not use tobacco products. And yet, I've been there 17 years. Every single day I'm on campus, I'm exposed to secondhand smoke. So we've got those issues. But we've made real progress. And I want to point this out. When I first came 17 years ago, they were smoking. There was a man who smoked on my hall in his office. And so we've made progress in getting it out of the building. So when people say to me, you can't possibly enforce this, nobody smokes in our buildings anymore. I mean, it's very rare to see that happen. So
they don't close their door and cheat a little bit?
No, because you can't. So, and we've also made real progress with the state, with the tobacco or clean air, our Smoke-Free Air Act that got the smoking out of restaurants. And we are ahead of the curve on a lot of ways in this state. We've got local ordinances, get them out of public buildings. Your building's got no smoking signs outside and the restroom doors. So you expect people not to smoke here.
Well, on a recent day, Professor Sylvester, in a story from the Associated Press, hoisted 2-gallon Ziploc bags packed with cigarette butts and thrust them toward the students in LSU's journalism building, and the stench of tobacco was discernible from several feet away. So what's your first step on this? You're talking about it, but what kind of action do you want immediately?
Well, we really, really want to try to first start with our quad area. And the reason that the quad is so important is because we have Middleton Library sitting on the end of the quad, right? And there's one door in and one door out. They're sliding doors, so they slide open. We have the majority, those butts that we picked up, we did in about an hour in front of Middleton. Had about 5 students doing that. We didn't even make a dent in some of the litter that's there. And so it's one of the really hot spots. The other one is the student union. And both of those areas have overhangs over the buildings. So if anybody smokes even under there or really close to there, that smoke gets drawn directly into the library. So, and I had a letter just a couple of days ago from a student who said, I just don't go to the library. I can't go over there. I can't stand breathing the secondhand smoke. And that is a large number of people. And again, my last survey showed 25% of the students, undergrad students, told us they were adversely affected by secondhand smoke.
297-5633, Dr. Judith Sylvester on a smoking crusade at LSU. And Southern, by the way, has already done this, so it's not something that she is out on a limb by herself. She is following the lead of several universities around the country. HB in Denham Springs. HB, good morning to you.
Good morning, sir. Doctor, please don't take this as being facetious on my part, but the last news that I've heard is that obesity is now the number one threat to American health in the United States, period, and affects more people at a younger age to an older age than smoking ever did. My question is this. Are we looking at times where someone is going to be there to check your BMI, to sit in a classroom seat, an airline seat, or when you go into McDonald's or Burger King? Bottom line, when is enough enough? Thank
you. All right. Thank you, HB. Judith?
Well, first of all, I would dispute your statistics on that. I don't think there's any argument that tobacco is still the number one preventable cause of death, not just in this state, but in the country and in the world. The World Health Organization has made tobacco use one of their main targets, trying to work on that issue. And actually, I mean, I don't really want to get into all the rest of this because I'm not an expert in any of that. But I can tell you that New York, which has one of the strongest anti-tobacco policies, are working on the sugar and things like that, and is creating a big stir.
Maybe we should do that too.
Well, that's, like I said, that's somebody else's mm-hmm. fight.
No, I remember when I was a student, not only was smoking prevalent on campus, but they actually had a bar that operated in the basement of Hatcher Hall. Mm-hmm. They served beer in the union.
Yeah, things change.
Times have changed.
But if you want some statistics on...
Let's go to a few lines and few callers, and you can recite those as we move along. Dr. Judith Sylvester fired up about smoking at LSU. Deborah in Denham Springs. Hi, Deborah. You're on with Dr. Sylvester.
Hi, Dr. Sylvester. I'm curious. I personally have acquired adult asthma due to being exposed to mold and mildew in a place I was living. And I have trouble going in anywhere. I'm also chemically sensitive, and obviously cigarette smoke really impacts me. And I, there are places I can no longer go, pubs, to hear bands if people are smoking, and there's no outdoor venue. But I have to say, having lost someone to lung cancer who was a heavy smoker, I just can't see us policing everything everybody does. I don't understand why it isn't enough for people to smoke outside and why you want to ban it from the campus.
All right, go ahead. Thank you, Deborah.
Well, LSU is my workplace, and we are all entitled to a safe workplace. And it's simply not safe. It is a health and safety issue. I mentioned the tobacco butts, but what people don't realize is that all of that carcinogens from those leftover butts go down into our ground. They get into LSU lakes. It's not healthy. And we don't only just have secondhand smoke. We have third-hand smoke because I can always tell when a student's coming in from outside. They come up, hand me something. I know if they've been smoking or not, and I immediately react to it. I'm very sensitive to it. So it is personal for me as well. But I cannot go from my car, which I park in the Indian Mound lots, to my building, which is Hodges, without encountering at least one and usually multiple smokers along the way.
Sweet White, name from the past, says, this is absurd. I don't need LSU restricting my perfectly legal behavior as a student on campus, smoking or otherwise. Enforcing litter laws in the no-smoking zone within 25 feet of building entrances is a better route to take. That being said, smokers should have more respect for non-smokers on campus, but an all-out ban is not part of LSU's mission or job. We'll be back with Dr. Judith Sylvester after this one-minute timeout. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. All of Southern University's campuses have banned tobacco that started in January, a move by the Board of Supervisors, which made Southern the first college in Louisiana to ban all tobacco products. And LSU, if Dr. Judith Sylvester has her way, and by the way, she's not alone. There are many others, and she certainly speaks for the majority of people on campus who are non-smokers. Dr. Sylvester says no smoking at LSU and no tobacco use at all would be a step forward. What do you think? Lori in South Downs. Lori in South Downs, you're on with Dr. Sylvester.
Hi, Dr. Sylvester. Hi, Jim. I just came back from a year at a University of California campus, and while it's not banned to smoke on campus, smoking is so unacceptable that it was really very, very clean. And I just came back to LSU recently, and I've been coughing ever since. And I'm being treated by a pulmonologist, and it's been over a month that I've been coughing. I don't think that smokers really understand that as they walk around the campus, they're just leaving trails of smoke. I'll cross the street, and that person will cross the street, or somebody else on the other side of the street is smoking. There is no way to get out of the smoke. And this is a matter not just of smokers' rights, but of other people's basic rights to be able to live a healthy life.
All right. Thank you, Lori. Dr. Sylvester?
Well, that's the whole point, is that we think that the average smoker doesn't realize what kinds of problems they're creating. And I'm sorry, but I have to give you some statistics here. This is Louisiana, the state. And one of the things we know is the annual health care cost in Louisiana directly caused by smoking is $1.47 billion. That's billion with a B. The portion covered by the state Medicaid program is $663 million. The resident state and federal tax burden from smoking-causing government expenditures, this is per household in our state, is $649 per household. So we're all paying for this one way or another. And then smoking-caused productivity losses in Louisiana is a little over $2 billion. So it is a big problem for all of us. And the reason it's important for LSU to step up to this is because there's good statistics out now that show that people, if they can make it to age 26 without smoking, they're not likely to start smoking. But we're getting them coming to campus as non-smokers and starting to pick up the habit and leaving as smokers, which is just unacceptable by any standard.
297-5633. What about the taxing situation in Louisiana? We have a tax that's about $4 a pack lower than New York State. Presumably, if we raised it to that level, we could restore all the funding for higher education and for health care. Would you be in favor of a cigarette and tobacco tax that would exceed the level we now have?
Yes, but let me again put that into some perspective. We are, Missouri has a lower one than we do. They're working on trying to get that increased right now. But we're near the bottom of states in terms of the amount of money that we tax cigarettes. The main reason, in my view, to do this is because it's statistically true that you get fewer young people starting to smoke if you've got a higher tax on cigarettes. But it's an uphill battle in this state. As we well know, we had trouble even keeping the 4-cent renewable on it last time this all came up. But it's definitely important, and I hope that if we do make another run at this, that we do earmark some of it for LSU, or well, not just LSU, but all college campuses in the state, to provide smoking cessation aids and support and education.
Dr. Sylvester is correct. Missouri, 17 cents per pack. Louisiana, according to last report, 36 cents. And New York State, $4.35 per pack. Ray in Prairieville. Hi, Ray. You're on with Dr. Sylvester.
Thanks for taking my call, Jim. By the way, first of all, our condition, before my question, our condition is, I am an ex-smoker, but about 25 years ago. I'd like to ask Dr. Sylvester if she thinks that it would be an advantage to label smokers as addicts. We all know that nicotine and smoking is an addiction. And instead of just saying smokers, it sounds rather harmless. We know that severe penalties we pay for smoking. Why don't we get honest and just say it's an addiction, you're an addict, and address it that way? Maybe we could show a little bit of more progress that way.
Well, the problem is that tobacco's legal for those 18 and over. So it's a little bit hard to do that. But I don't think anybody who's been, who I would consider a regular smoker, somebody who smokes probably every day, would argue with the fact that they're addicted to nicotine. And it is harder to kick than just about any other substance that we know of. And it is even more difficult for women, which just astronomically increases the problems we have, because that leads to smoking during pregnancy. Very low birth weight babies are statistically a result of that. And then in addition to that, you now have a lot of links to SIDS, which means that small babies that are exposed to secondhand smoke after they're born are more likely to die from SIDS. And so we have those kinds of issues to deal with. But I also want to point out that it's not just a physical addiction. It's also a mental addiction, if you will, or a habit that people get into. They don't think about it. They don't really even realize a lot of times how much they're consuming in terms of tobacco. And they also don't stop and sit down and figure out what it costs them. And there's some pretty good programs online where you can calculators where you can put in how much you're smoking, what it's costing you, and project over 17, 18 years how much money you're going to spend.
John in South Downs. John, you're on with Dr. Sylvester.
Hi. Great show today. However, you know, I don't smoke. I've never smoked. I hate smoking. But I think people should be left alone, and you know, the smoking Nazis are driving me crazy. This thing about somebody across the street smoking and disturbing me, give me a break. You know, enough's enough, guys. Come on.
Well, first of all, it's not always across the street. I happen to have in my building two receptacles right outside my door that I have to pass through if I go in the front door to use the elevator. So it's not that. But it's, again, we're not telling anybody they have to stop smoking. We just want them not to smoke on our campus. And we've got all of these really, really good reasons why that should happen. And actually, I don't know that there are any good reasons to not try to prevent it. And we just, I mean, I can't get a smoker. Most smokers actually try to quit. Most of them want to quit. And we need to make it easier for them to quit. And we need to support their quitting. So it's not like we can just say no more smoking on the campus. It's pretty complicated, actually, in terms of how you support, particularly staff members, some faculty, it's higher for staff, in terms of getting them to change habits that they've had, some of them for 17 or more years, like I have seen. Just, you know, it's very hard.
Have you ever smoked?
Not directly, but I've certainly been the recipient of passive smoke since I was a kid. So I've never been able to really escape it.
In an ideal world, Dr. Sylvester, would you like to see a smoking banned altogether?
Well, I don't like the word ban. I really don't like to see it turn into something that's a legalistic argument. What I want is for us to change our culture, and that's really what we're working toward at LSU. If we can change the culture at LSU, and by the way, there are other parts of the system that are tobacco-free, the Health Sciences Center in New Orleans, Pennington, have moved in that direction. Eunice has been trying to do some things. They're sitting there waiting for us to be a little bit more strong in the leadership position on this. But we're not going to do it legal by changing laws except what we've done already.
Well, we'll follow it with you, and thanks for coming in this morning. Dr. Judith Sylvester, Mass Communications Professor at Louisiana State University and anti-smoking zealot. Thank you. We're joined now by the last man to win 30 games in a major league season. He was 31-6 in 1968 with the Detroit Tigers, and 44 years ago, Dennis Dale McLain was preparing for Game 6 of the World Series against the St. Louis Cardinals. He has a record that is unlikely to be broken in our lifetime, and that would mean somebody listening to the radio right now who's 2 or 3 years old. Pitchers just don't throw like they used to as far as games started and innings pitched. Good morning, Denny McLain.
Boy, if you got 2 and 3 year olds listening to the show, we got some demographics here.
Hopefully they're listening. It's a family show.
Was your previous segment about smoking or anti-smoking?
Yes.
Yeah, well, good. You can't win 5, 10, 20, 30 games. You can't win it if you're going to smoke. I mean, it's nothing worse in the world for you.
Well, since you brought up consumption, Denny, there was a time when you consumed quite a few Pepsis, if I remember right.
Well, you know, unfortunately, well, good thing that the Pepsis don't have nicotine in them, and some of them are other carcinogens, but the bottom line is, yeah, I still drink probably 15 a day Diet Pepsis, and I've been doing that for what seems like 100 years right now, and mix a Twinkie in once in a while. And my doctor recently, about a month ago, said, because we were talking about doing that lap band, you know, to lose a little bit of weight. And he said, I'm afraid to have you do anything. He says, listen, here you are at 68 years old. He says, I don't know if you're going to live another week, a day, or a month, or 10 years. He says, but I'm betting on at least 10 more for you. He says, you do the same thing every day. You eat the same thing every day. You drink the same thing. And I've never drank, by the way, either. And the bottom line is, he said, I'm not going to change anything. He said, be totally 110% your decision. And he says, my recommendation is you don't do it. So, you know, what the hell, I guess I can just continue to eat diet Twinkies and Diet Pepsi. So, the hell with the world, right?
In your heyday, though, I recall reading that you drank a case of Pepsi a day.
Oh, yeah. I would drink probably anywhere from 20 to 30 a day. You know, and let me correct that. You know, anybody drinking 30 a day, 25 a day, that's all you would have time for. That means I opened up 20 or 30 a day. And, you know, I, in my home, on the road, it didn't make any difference. You knew whose room you were in or whose house you were in when you walked in, if there were always 2 or 3 cans of Pepsi sitting around that had gotten warm, and or I had forgotten where I left the last one and went and got another one. So, you know, it's not like I drank 20 or 30 a day, but I certainly drank more than my fair share.
Well, Denny McLain set the world afire 44 years ago. He was 24 years old. That year, you pitched 336 innings in the regular season, another 16 and change in the postseason. That's over 350 innings. Steven Strasburg is 24 years old, and they shut him down. The Washington Nationals did after 160 innings. What do you think about the way the game has changed and the pampering, if you will, of major league pitchers?
Well, this thing with Strasburg is ridiculous, and let me tell you why it's so ding-dang ridiculous, and I don't think you'd find anybody else but besides the management of Washington to say what I'm going to say. You know, last year when he got hurt, didn't they know he was going to get hurt? Are they that good? Are they that genius in their mind that they should have seen the injury last year? So now they're going to go overboard and make sure he never gets hurt again. You know, I got to tell you something. It is an abnormal thing to throw a ball overhand or sidearm. We all do it when we play in that crazy game, and we take the chances that it has contained within the game. I mean, it takes one slider, it takes one curveball, it takes a whole lot more fastballs to hurt your arm. But if you're throwing breaking balls, you're throwing sliders and all the other stuff that goes along with it, every time you throw a pitch could be your last pitch in the big leagues. I mean, the best example is look at Mark Fidrich with our Detroit club in 82 or 83, whatever year it was. And Mark come up and win a quick 19 games, and he never won another game because he hurt his shoulder. He, of course, just recently he died of a horrible accident. But the bottom line simply is you just don't know. There are no geniuses. Now, if they want to put metal in our arms, you know, in our elbows and in our shoulders and titanium here and titanium there, I mean, hell, I'm thinking about a comeback. If I could be painless, I'd go out and pitch tomorrow. I saw a television show the other day. They were talking about taking a certain part of the brain and lobotomizing it and taking the pain section out. God, I wish I'd have mentioned that 30 years ago.
Now, you used a cortisone quite frequently, didn't you?
Yeah, we were sold. This was the worst sales job on a group of people in the history of maybe a modern America. And I'm not disparaging the military. The military has certainly been put through hell in World War I, World War II, Vietnam. But what I want to say is they sat us down one day and said, listen, we have a cure-all drug. It's called cortisone. And it can't hurt you. All it can do is quickly speed up the inflammation area. In other words, take the inflammation out of the damaged area, and within 3 or 4 days again, you'll be able to pitch. You know, they were right to some degree. I mean, I think the first 8 or 10 of those shots that I had, every time I got the shot, I had almost immediate relief. Of course, part of the relief was from azelaicane, the freezing agent. But after that, it without having to throw for a day or two, it always got better and better and better. Well, lo and behold, we didn't know it, as I stated, and all it was covering up the injury. And eventually, when you've damaged it beyond the ability to repair it, and we didn't certainly have the Tommy John surgery back then, there was no way that we were coming back. I mean, I don't care what drug they tried to give you, what pill they tried to give you, what color it was, how big it was. Nothing could help it. Sure, you could get a little bit of pain relief in the beginning of the ball game, but, you know, pain relief wears off just like anything else. And we were subjected to that cortisone stuff and a lot of other goofy stuff. But, you know, those were the days when they could get away with it. They can't do that today. Everybody, including the player's mother now, has to approve anything that they do. But I think they've gone way over the line with Strasburg. He should be pitching. Now, you know, they've got such a good club, even without him. But with him, I think they were a lock for the World Series. I don't think there's any question. And, you know, we got quite a guy here by the name of Verlander,
yep,
who is as good as there is in the game today. I suggest this to you in the strongest terms. I think Strasburg, and it's hard for me to say this, but I think Strasburg's got better stuff. Justin's fastball doesn't explode when it gets in the strike zone. Justin's fastball is just fast. If you believe the numbers, 95 to 100 miles an hour. Strasburg not only throws the ball up there also, but his ball within 5 or 6 feet of home plate literally explodes on the hitter. And that explosion-type fastball is an incredible pitch. Wherever, you know, there are very few guys that ever come to the big leagues with that pitch, but he's got it. And I just don't understand. Because, listen, here's a guy that you could really protect, even if you're scared to death of him getting hurt. And, when he walks down the stairs today at his home, he could break a leg and be done anyway. But my point is, if you just tell him to go out and throw fastballs for 6 or 7 innings, folks, he can get by with just a fastball. He doesn't need a curveball. He doesn't need a slider right now. He's got that kind of stuff with a fastball.
We're hearing the voice of Denny McClain. 31 wins in 1968 when he was 24, another 24 wins the following season, 325 innings pitched, and then your career changed. You were not the same. What happened?
It was the rotator cuff. I just literally, when they were able to get in there eventually, they just said it's as close to a severed rotator cuff they had ever seen. And so after that, they went back to more cortisone and I had people, listen, funny stuff. I mean, I had a doctor out in Oakland when I was traded to Oakland. He says, meet me at my apartment today. And he was a traveling doctor with the team, but that sounded suspicious to me. And I went to his apartment to meet him. He says, I've got an injection here for you. He says, it's going to hurt a little bit, but believe me, in a day or two, you're going to feel a million miles better. So I went there, and he shoved it right into my spine. And I want to tell you, now I know why men don't have babies. God almighty, I jumped up out of that seat. I turned around. The funniest thing was when I turned around trying to get the hell out of his apartment, I saw he had his shirt off.
We'll return with Denny McClain, the 31-game winner for the Tigers in 68, after this one-minute pause. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Kevin Gallagher producing. 297-5633 is your number. Inkstershow@WRKF.org works if you'd like to reach us online. We're talking with Denny McClain, whose record of 30 wins in 1968 will be unlikely to be broken anytime soon, maybe never. He was the first pitcher since Dizzy Dean in 1934 to eclipse 30 victories in a season. Denny McLain did it with a world champion team 44 years ago in the great city of Detroit. Now, 5 years later, when I was 15 and you were 29, you were pitching for the Shreveport Captains, and I saw you pitch a couple of times at Ray Winder Field in Little Rock, Arkansas. One bad game, one good game for you. This was only 5 years removed from you being the biggest star in the universe. How did you adapt to this?
Well, you know what? It was a last-ditch effort to see if I could come back. I had taken quite a bit of time off after the 71 or 72 season, and it was just one of those things. You know, you don't want to give up that game. I mean, that is the greatest game of all of them. It has all of the perks. It has all the bells and whistles, and it's got the greatest fans all over the country versus any other sport. And unfortunately, it didn't work out well. I mean, I had a great time in we're up Shreveport, and I had a great time, and I tried it in Des Moines, Iowa for a little while. And, you know, as I got a little stronger, I went up back up to AAA and tried to pitch, but it was no good. I mean, it was, you know, again, they were still coming at me with cortisone. We had found out about the sins of cortisone, and so therefore we were taking less of it, and we couldn't even get the inflammation out at that point in time. But also, I was having a debate with myself whether I was going to stay in the game. I had restaurants in Atlanta at the time because that's the club I finished with. And I was trying to figure out if I was going to stay in the restaurant business or if I was going to, you know, look for something else to do, namely in baseball. And that's probably one of the worst mistakes I made in the sense that I decided not. I was offered a color job with the Chicago White Sox to do color radio. And I turned it down just because it was at that point it wasn't the right thing for me. I was still looking for something which I'm not sure what I was looking for, but I was looking for something more comfortable than having to travel again and having to be on the road another 100 days a year. So my wife would have been unfair to do that to her again. So we just said no, and we moved on.
Well, a complex legacy. I think you would agree with that. And in 1968, Denny McLain was of such a big star. Tim Wendell was on this show, and he wrote a book about that year. And
Tim's a great guy.
He said there was no bigger star in the history of the game than you in 1968.
Well, I'm not sure if that's true. I think maybe in 68, yes, to some degree. We still got to remember, we still had Mickey Mantle. We still had Reggie Jackson just coming into the big leagues. We really had some Carl Yastrzemski, Tony Oliva. You know, we really had some great players at the time.
Did you groove a pitch to Mickey Mantle?
That was my idol. I'll answer it that way. You know, you can go on Kindle and you can buy the book, too, see the real story. But Mickey was my idol. I was born and raised in Chicago. I had two groups that I loved all my life. Number one was Mickey Mantle, and number two were the Chicago Cubs, despite the fact that I signed with the White Sox. But, you know, you start this wandering contest with yourself, and you're quite not sure what you're going to do. And all of a sudden, you know, it's over with. And then all of a sudden you got a wife and four kids. Boy, I'll tell you, that's when life gets serious. All of a sudden you can't throw a fastball or a curveball or a slider anymore. And then you turn around and you go home that night and you see your wife and your four kids are, what are we going to do now, Dad? And, you know, those are the toughest moments for me as I look back in our marriage.
Dan downtown. Dan, you're on with Denny McLain.
Hi, Dan.
Hi. You mentioned tobacco addiction. Didn't former Tigers center fielder Bill Tuttle die from chewing tobacco?
Gosh, what was the name again?
Bill Tuttle.
No, I'll tell you one guy who had a horrible addiction to cigarettes was Eddie Matthews, the great third baseman with the Braves, who was later became my manager in Atlanta for a short period of time. We had a shortstop named Roy Euler. I mean, I roomed with Ray for 5 years, and believe me, this is the god awful truth. I have never had a cigarette in my mouth. My dad died from cigarette smoking. My dad used to smoke 3 packs a day. I mean, I don't know what else he could have been doing, but he was smoking 3 packs a day. Those were the, you know, when boys would be boys, they'd have a beer between their legs and one cigarette after another. As I remember, Viceroy, I don't know if they're even still around, but Viceroy is what he's, I'll never forget it. But there have been a lot. Listen, we got a guy with the Tigers now. Jimmy Leland is a horrible addictive smoker. Jimmy probably goes through at least two. I guarantee you this: it's at least one pack a day. Now he may not smoke them all because when he's in a dugout, he's got to walk down the ramp and try to smoke as much as he can between hitters. But I'll tell you that he is as serious a cigarette smoker as I've ever seen.
Chris at the state capitol, you're on with Denny McClain. Hi, Chris.
Good morning, Mr. McClain.
Morning, Chris. How are you?
10 years old in 1968, and boys made me a lifelong Tigers fan. Then moved back to Washington and was there in 71. Quite a contrast between those two teams and those two cities.
You think?
Yeah. So tell me, what was it like going from being on the top of the American League to darn near the bottom?
First of all, both of those teams were good guys. I mean, they were just they were fun to play with. Good guys, as a bunch of guys playing with each other all year long would be. But the Washington Senators that year were the best guys I have ever been around on a continuing basis. We had the worst manager in the history of baseball, Ted Williams. I mean, there wasn't anybody that ever lived that was any worse than Ted. Ted also, if you could not hit 330, you were not on his favorite list. By the way, we never had a guy on our team that hit 330 that year. So he had a very short list with only his name at the top. Ted was nasty, for the lack of a better term, and there's a lot of terms I could use, but and I'll give you the best example. We had Curt Flood. Curt Flood, of course, went against and went to federal court to get the free agency application involved into baseball, where everybody now can make lots of money and have been making money for years now, 30 years. They owe it all to Curt Flood. And Curt was a 10- or 11-time gold glover with the St. Louis Cardinals. And Ted hated him, despised him, because, first of all, he was the guy that challenged baseball. And Ted would talk about it from time to time. So one night when there's about 2,000, 3,000 people in the ballpark, Curt strikes out on a high fastball and goes and gets his glove and goes all the way out in center field. Now, this is a 10-time, 11-time All-Star. Just to embarrass Curt, he takes Curt out of the game in the top of the fourth inning for defensive purposes. We're already behind 1-0 or 2-0, and he takes him out for defensive purposes. Curt walked right over him and said, "What the hell are you taking me out of the game for?" He says, "Because I can." The next day, if you may or may not recall, Curt Flood got on an airplane and went to Mallorca for the next 15 years, and he ran his I think he had a small resort over there, and that's what he did. But Ted Williams ran him out of the game. He was trying real hard to make some kind of a comeback and at least finish one more year. And Ted was almost impossible. If I didn't have a wife and four kids, I may have left too. Because if I didn't go on the disabled list for 21 to 25 days that year, I probably would have lost 30.
Yeah, 10 and 22 after being...
Yeah, we were terrible. Yeah. We couldn't catch it. We couldn't hit it. We couldn't hit a cutoff man. We couldn't bunt it. We barely got into the park to put our uniforms on in the same manner with each other. I mean, we were. It was the best guys, though. It was the best guys. One of the guys was Frank Howard, all 6'8" of them. Every night when we were on the road about 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning, he would bring White Castles back to the hotel for everybody. And then, of course, you know, whatever White Castles develops in your stomachs at 3:30 in the morning, you didn't want to light a match on that floor.
Denny McClain, as you can hear, he's a man who can craft a phrase. He was a talk show host, among other things, after leaving the game, and a radio owner. And Denny McClain, of course, has spent some time in prison. How was that experience?
Well, it wasn't the most pleasant place to be. You know, we all know that we make mistakes from time to time, and my mistake was a little higher profile than most. And, you know, it is what it is. I mean, the best thing I can say about it, without going into any details of who, what, where, and when, is, you know, my family stood by me. My friends stood by me. To my knowledge, I didn't lose any friends. I mean, I may have, but I don't recall losing any. And I think people knew me better than that, and I think they trusted me more than that. But, you know, it is what it is. The system is a tough system. And you got to be ready for it. God forbid you get close and, you know, don't want to do that again. That was, you know, it's not only the punishment involved that is the horrible part to go through. But what you've denied your family at that point in time, what you've denied your kids, that's what I feel most sorry for, what I took away from my wife and my children for those years. And it was awful. That's the nicest thing I could say about it. It was awful.
I don't know of any man who's had more highs and lows, and I mean real highs and deep lows, than you. You lost a child as well.
Yeah, that, you know, and I try to always complete this story about going to jail, is that, listen, that was like a pimple on a goat's butt, going to jail, because when you lose a child like we did to the hands of a drunken truck driver, you know what life is all about. You know how valuable life can be. You know what life really defines. And we lost a daughter, Kristen. She'd been married 3 years. She was 26 years old, just gorgeous. And some truck driver come up over a little hill, drunk as a skunk, at 2:30 in the morning. She was coming home from work. She had worked late. She was an accountant. And she was coming home late because it was that time of year. And bottom line is the guy, she never saw his trucks. He had his lights turned off across a four-lane highway so he could see into the place. He was backing the truck up at 2:15 in the morning, because when he turned his back lights on, a bad glare came off the glass that he was trying to back into. And lo and behold, she never saw him. She came up over the hill, and there he was. There was no room for error. She come up, boom, the truck was there. Mm-hmm. You never get over that one. Uh-huh. That's one that it goes on every day. I don't care what happens. Every day there's at least a half a dozen things that remind you of her. And like I said, going to jail was like a pimple on a goat's butt compared to that.
Now, this year, Barry Bonds, Roger Clemens, Sammy Sosa, they'll all be eligible for the Hall of Fame. Do you think they should be voted in?
You tell me which one's going to get in.
I don't think any of them are going to get in.
I don't think any of them are
going to get in. I think Bonds and Clemens should get in.
Well, I think at one time they certainly deserved it, but you know what? Once they went red juice, it was all over with.
Not Red Bull, red juice, right?
Well, yeah, red juice, and I mean, it's potent stuff, they say. And there's one other guy, I think, who kind of gives you the measuring stick, and that's McGuire. McGuire can't get a vote right now to get out of the 7-Eleven. So I think if they didn't put McGuire into the Hall of Fame when his turn came up, none of these guys will ever get in during our lifetime. I mean, I heard somebody say Pete Rose should get in the other day, and I said, wait a minute. When these guys go in, that's when we'll start talking about Pete. But Pete did one thing worse than even what these guys did. Pete bet on the game. And there's a big, big card in the – I'm sure you've been in a big league clubhouse. And the first thing you see when you walk into a big league clubhouse is, you shall be suspended and terminated from the game of Major League Baseball if you bet on the game of baseball. It's right there. Nobody can miss it. Nobody can excuse themselves for missing it. And Pete not only bet on other teams, Pete bet on the Cincinnati Reds to win and or lose. And, folks, if you read the report, it's 222 pages long. I've known Pete 45 years, and the toughest thing for me in the world to do, I was on radio and TV at the time when this all happened, and I had people from the commissioner's office, and I argued like hell until I read the 222-page report, and lo and behold, there's no question that he did a horrible thing. He bet on and against the Cincinnati Reds, and when you do that, you've got nothing coming. I mean, just nothing coming. And I know Pete knows that now. I mean, I don't know what this dog and pony show was for a little while when the commissioner had lunch with him one day and they talked, but it's just never going to happen.
Now, Steve Carlton was the last pitcher to throw for 300 innings in a season. That was 1980, 32 years ago. You did it twice. Now it won't happen. That's a big reason why no one will even get close to 30 wins.
Sure.
Unless something changes. But yesterday I heard Tommy Lasorda say that pitchers actually strengthen their arms from throwing, that they're being, in his view, babied. Do you think that's the case?
Oh, I agree. Tommy and I, when we do see each other a couple of times a year, we both agree on basically the same circumstances. In other words, I used to throw, and I'm not sure if Tommy means to imply that the arm gets stronger. What I always say is the following. If you throw the ball every day, you will learn something about yourself. When I would pitch, on, let's say, on a Monday, and then my next term would be Friday. And I would throw Tuesday, I would throw Wednesday, and I would throw Thursday. Now, I didn't go out there and throw for 25 minutes. On the day after I pitched on Monday, I would throw about 5 or 6 minutes just to make sure all the parts were still working. Then on Wednesday, I would throw about 7 or 8 minutes, and I'd spin the ball, little curveball, little slider, little curveball, little slider, changeup. And then on Thursday, I would just throw another 5 or 6 minutes. What it did for me was it kept my spin consistent. And you don't hear a lot about spin with baseballs, but every pitcher kind of throws their own kind of spin. And what I used to do is sit in the dugout with a ball, and I used to spin it for 7 or 8 innings every night in a ball game, whether it be a curveball or a slider or a changeup. But I would get used to the grip all the time. And every once in a while, you'd learn something about yourself when you were out there in between starts or when you were sitting on the bench. You'd say, hey, man, let me try this. For instance, Verlander throws a curveball, and he doesn't put any fingers on a seam. I mean, that's hard to believe that he puts no fingers on a seam. He's the only one that I've ever seen that in all the years I've been in the game. Yet I used to throw a curveball with one finger, so that's pretty close to what Verlander does today. But his curveball is much quicker than mine was in the sense of velocity. Those are the things you learn about yourself. I could never throw a good curveball with two fingers, so I backed off and tried it with one, and mm-hmm. eventually worked for me. Sliders, change-ups, but I did that on the bench all the time. I literally would spin the ball in a ball game that I wasn't pitching in for 6 or 7 innings every night just to continue to get a better grip, to find out what grips could be better and what grips could give me more effectiveness on the mound.
Well, Denny McClain, this has been fun. Thank you. And 44 years ago, he was getting ready for Game 6 in St. Louis. The Tigers won Games 4, 5, and 6 to beat the Cardinals in 7 games. And the game has changed quite a bit, but Denny's record remains intact. 31-6 in 1968. Thank you, Denny
McClain. And you know what? The state of Louisiana is one of my favorite states. I spent a lot of time down there in the New Orleans area, and there are no greater people in the world than the people from Louisiana. Thank you. I really enjoyed myself.
Thank you, and we'll be back tomorrow. Until then, stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.